I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 14th of October. The men who united the states, America's explorers, inventors, eccentrics, and mavericks, and the creation of one nation indivisible has just been published. Simon Winchester is the author, and he is our guest this hour. He's had an amazing life. He's a journalist, an author, a broadcaster. He's worked as a foreign correspondent for much of his career for The Guardian and The Sunday Times, writing from Belfast, Washington, D.C., New Delhi, New York, London, Hong Kong. He contributes to a number of American and British magazines and journals, writes and presents television, films, frequent contributor to the BBC Radio. His books are on so many subjects: the colonial architecture of India, aristocracy, the American Midwest, his experience of months in an Argentine prison on spying charges, his description of a six-month walk through the Korean Peninsula, the Pacific Ocean, and the future of China. In this particular book, he recently became an American citizen, too, and did a long, long journey to compile this book. The question that he is addressing is, how has America managed to adhere for all these 250 years? What is it that that makes us able to stay the United States? And he looks at the ties that bind us through five elements, and we'll talk about that. I do want to remind you that Simon Winchester will be in Milwaukee talking about his book, Boswell Books, this coming Friday night at 7 o'clock. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And you can always leave messages for us on our Facebook page, and that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. Simon Winchester, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, it's a delight. Hello, good afternoon.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. I would like to start, if you don't mind. You had thought about this for 50 years, and recently you became an American citizen. Why did you want to do that?
Well, I mean, I suppose the obvious reason really is that no taxation without representation. I was paying taxes in Massachusetts, which is not called Taxachusetts for nothing. And I thought, if I'm not allowed to vote, this is monstrous. I should be allowed to vote, and the only way I can do that is to become an American. But it was rather more than that. It was an emotional thing. I've been effectively enraptured by this country ever since I first came here as a hitchhiking student in 1962, when everyone was so incredibly kind to me. Mm. I mean, just as an illustration of that kindness, I entered the United States in Blaine in Washington, and 8 months later exited from Houlton in Maine, had done 38,000 miles on an incredibly complicated
Goodness.
Trip. But I entered America with $200 in my pocket and left with $182, meaning I spent only $18 because everyone was so generous and kind and nice.
Oh, that's
and
wonderful.
And it left an incredible legacy.
Isn't that? And you did a lot of exploration for this book, too, didn't you? You traveled a long distance.
Well, I certainly did. I mean, it's many very long, mostly transcontinental journeys in the footsteps of other people. I mean, Lewis and Clark, the obvious ones, but also in the footsteps of the people that effectively planned the interstate highway system and big transcontinental railway journey. So, yes, I went hither and yon all over the country.
Equipping yourself with a tent, a compass, a sleeping bag, as well as books by classic American writers, Willa Cather, Wallace Stegner, John Williams, Theodore Dreiser, and others. And I'd like to talk about this a moment, the WPA guides, government-made books that you consider to be among the best ever made guides to the states.
I do. I took a long time to make a complete collection of the state guides. I mean, there are city guides. That would be, you know, even more expensive and more obsessive collecting, and there are other guides as well. But I thought I'd get all 50 of the states. Of course, there were only 48 states, but they did guides to both Alaska and Hawaii in the 1930s, too. And these are the most wonderful books produced, as you'll know, during the Depression by this organization called the Works Progress Administration, which hired writers and artists and sculptors to do all sorts of public artistic works to keep them working. And they hired writers to help produce these guidebooks to the states. And very famous writers they were, who were unemployed at the time. I mean, part of the California Guide, for instance, was written by John Steinbeck. And these are collector's items now.
Oh.
And the although they're out of date in terms of recommending hotels, was most of the hotels in those days cost about $3 a night or less. Doesn't apply these days. But the quality of the writing and the description of the histories of the various states, they are truly wonderful books. Never have they been repeated. I've been trying to persuade Oxford University Press to do them all over again and let me be the series editor, but thus far they've said, we'll think about it.
Oh, keep working on that. That would be a wonderful thing for you to do. And as you suggest, government can serve a purpose. We have to be reminded of that during this week in particular, right?
Well, I do. I hope I'm not jumping ahead of myself, but there's one, I think, extraordinary irony. One of the items that I write about in, and I know you're going to talk about the structure of this book, because it is a slightly eccentric structure, but in the final chapter or section of the book, I talk about the bringing of electricity to rural America, because in the 1930s, all the cities were connected electrically and all the lights were glowing and the machines were humming. But out on the farms, 800,000 American farms, the electric companies deemed it too uneconomic to string wires to allow them to receive electricity. So FDR set up, among a myriad other organizations, the Rural Electrification Administration, which had the single purpose of bringing electricity to the farms. And there are wonderfully romantic stories about how that was done. But the irony that I mentioned is that the very first place in the country to have its farms connected by government-sponsored electricity, if we can put it like that, government-underwritten electricity, was the 8th Congressional District of Ohio, Western Ohio, a place, oddly enough, called Miami, Ohio. The 8th Congressional District today is represented in Congress by John Boehner, the Speaker of the House, the man who is implacably opposed to big government.
Oh, interesting.
So I think you will find it an irony that his district, represented now by a man who's absolutely anti-government, benefited hugely, critically, from big government half a century ago.
Mm-hmm. So the idea of how you would organize this huge book came to you while you were writing a letter to a friend in China. You've lived everywhere, so you've got friends everywhere. So what was in the letter?
Well, I can't remember the contents of the letter, but it was when I was writing it to him that I thought to myself, because I had lived in China for a long time, and I was flailing about, not really knowing how to organize this book about America, very well aware that writing about my new, as a new minted citizen, that if I got it wrong, people who knew a far greater deal about this country than I ever could would immediately jump all over me, and I wanted to get it right. So my publishers and I, we thought of several different strategies for how we do this book and organizing this enormous amount of information into a manageable form. And when I was writing this letter to my chum, I suddenly thought five Chinese classical elements, not just Chinese, in Japan and Korea and indeed as far west as India, there's this, for hundreds, thousands of years, there's been this belief that there are five elements that are central to everything. And those elements are wood, earth, water, fire, and metal. And it suddenly occurred to me that I could possibly organize all these people and all their achievements in uniting the country together under these five great headings. And as I sort of looked more carefully, things did begin rather neatly to slot into the five headings. And so that's how I organized the book. And, we'll see what the critics have to say about it. I'm fully expecting someone to jump down my throat. But thus far, the people have been pretty nice about it.
They have been pretty nice and well-deserved. Let's start with Thomas Jefferson and with those forests. As we would sit with Jefferson at his home looking west, we would see a lot of wood, right? A lot of forest. Wood
indeed
was really important.
Right. And Jefferson, who loved trees, and he planted many in Monticello, and if one goes to Monticello today, you can see his planning as a as a gardener, as an arborist, and he did a wonderful job. But he was confronted when he sat on the western terrace of Monticello looking out towards the setting sun. He was confronted by this enormous range of not very high mountains, I mean about 3,500 feet, the Appalachians and or the Blue Ridge. And one peculiar thing about Jefferson is that although he was a world traveler, he after all had been American ambassador in Paris, he had never gone west of the Blue Ridge. And he was sitting in his study one day in late 1802 reading a book by a man called Alexander Mackenzie, who it was a book published in London, and it was a very sort of triumphal book saying how Mackenzie, who was a Canadian, had managed to cross the American continent on foot and by canoe in Canada. And Jefferson was apoplectic. He said, this is ridiculous that a Canadian should be the first to cross this continent. And he turned to his secretary, Meriwether Lewis, and said, Lewis, we've got to find out what this country is of ours is made of. Organize an expedition. And that was the beginning of the Lewis and Clark expedition, which did, of course, go across the Blue Ridge Mountains, and it did go to the Missouri and up the Missouri and across to the northwest of the United States. But Jefferson himself was never to see any of this remarkable territory that Lewis and Clark uncovered. And I think it's something, once again, of an irony, I don't want to overuse the word, that Jefferson, so well-traveled, never saw the West that so fascinated him.
He sat in his mind, I guess, huh?
Yes, I mean, there's another very important thing to say about Jefferson in this context, too. There's, in a place called East Liverpool, Ohio, there's an obelisk beside the road, which is, everyone bypasses it. You barely notice it as you flash past. There's sort of rubbish and litter there, and it's a very undistinguished-looking obelisk, but it's terribly important, because in 1785, when Jefferson was in the Congress, he saw to it that something called the Land Ordinance was passed, which allowed Americans to own land. Back in Britain, ordinary people were not allowed to own land. It was the church, it was the king, it was the aristocracy. But in order to make this new democracy work, Jefferson said, we've got to allow people to have land. But where is this land? Well, we've got to lay it out. We've got to map it. We've got to survey it. And to survey it, you have to draw a network of grid lines, north and south and east and west, and choose a place where you begin these survey lines from. And that thing, that entity, that obelisk called the Point of Beginning is in East Liverpool, Ohio. And if you go there, you see a straight line crossing the road, and that straight line continues to the west all the way out to the Pacific Ocean. And every time you fly across the western states of America and see neat farms laid out in squares in Nebraska or Kansas or Arizona, those squares all began in this funny little long-overlooked place, East Liverpool, Ohio. Hmm.
Simon Winchester is our guest this hour. His latest book is The Men Who United the States, America's Explorers, Inventors, Eccentrics, and Mavericks, and the Creation of One Nation, Indivisible. We'll continue our conversation with him about his extraordinary journey, this one in the United States. He's taken journeys all over the world. He's quite a guy. And welcome your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Kathleen Dunn with John Munson in our studios in Milwaukee, and this is our fall membership drive. You rely on WPR for informative, in-depth discussions, and we rely on you to keep programs like this one going strong. Your gift right now of any amount makes a difference. WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Hello, John.
Well, hello, Kathleen. Last hour, we heard from 16 listeners. Thank you very much for
those pledges.
The goal now is to get 25 pledges by 3 o'clock. Now, these goals are set up to make sure that, well, at the end of the year, we have the money that we need to pay for programs like the Kathleen Dunn program, programs that you rely on. So help us meet that goal with your gift at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
There may be many times that you have been listening to the Ideas Network and you heard something that stopped you in your tracks, something that was really interesting. We strive every day for programs that open your eyes and engage your brain, programs that affect your life. Talk about a book filled with really interesting pieces of information. It's Simon's book that we're talking about this hour. So those kinds of moments and that kind of radio happens only with your financial support at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Well, and here's something a lot of people miss. Giving takes just a few minutes of your time. Here's all we need. We need your name, contact information, how much you want to give, and how you'd like to pay. That's it. And when you use your credit card, it saves time, postage, and paper, and it puts your money to work right away. No matter how you choose to give or how much, please use the next few minutes to make your pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Certainly one common factor among WPR listeners is that they love to read, and John and I are both included in that group. Mm-hmm. We love to read. You have probably received a lot of book recommendations from your WPR listening, whether it's a book on this show, on Chapter a Day, something you heard on a news program that made you want to go out and learn a lot more on that topic.
Well, that's right, Kathleen. And your WPR listening leads to a never-ending book list. Your donation right now makes that kind of endless enjoyment and discovery possible. Please give now at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552 to keep those book recommendations coming.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a critical resource for the state, and the only way that it's going to be maintained in the long term is to have people who support it. I think it's great to be able to hear what is happening in various parts of the world. I think it's critical to have that resource available, whether we use it every day or not. I like being part of the system that is supporting WPR. Being a supporter of WPR is important for everyone so that they can make use of the resource that is available in our state. I'm Doug Nelson from Pewaukee, Wisconsin. I encourage you to join me as a sustainer of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Kathleen Dunn here with John Munson asking for your support of WPR during our fall membership drive. Your gift might be $10 or $20 a month. Whatever amount you choose is the right amount. WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Well, and pledge drives are a very important time for us to hear from new members, new contributors. So here's your question for the day. Are you a member yet? Well, if you aren't, take that step right now. Go to WPR.org or give us a call, 888-202-2552. Make a contribution of any amount. Let me suggest one, $5 a month. Well, when you do, you make WPR programs you count on every day possible.
And, John, we have 23 more pledges to go in about, 25 minutes? No, more than that, 35 minutes. So it's possible, and your support will make the difference here at WPR. It makes all of these great programs possible. We really want you to be a part of making it happen. Give now, WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
And we have a new WPR travel mug. You'll want to get one. Be the first person on your block with your new WPR travel mug. A pledge of $15 a month or more will get one for you. It's a handy reminder and a nice one, too, of how much you enjoy WPR. It's made by Clean Canteen. So get your new travel mug at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
If you're not already a sustainer, become one right now. Set up ongoing monthly donations from your bank account or credit card at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. A sustaining membership is really very convenient for you, and it provides reliable funding for WPR.
Your pledge now, very important. WPR.org, 888-202-2552. And thank you for your support of Wisconsin Public. Public
Thank
Radio.
You so much. Thanks, John. Simon Winchester is our guest this hour. He's written a terrific book. It's The Men Who United the States, America's Explorers, Inventors, Eccentrics, and Mavericks, and the Creation of One Nation Indivisible. He set off in writing this book on several months of exploration, and you can tell from reading this, he's actually explored many, many parts of the world and has written all kinds of best-selling books. We're welcoming phone calls for him at 800-486-8655, and let's go to some phone calls. Joe is calling in Lansing, Iowa. Hi, Joe.
Hi. Say, we've been to Monticello, and standing in the foyer there in Jefferson's home, it's quite extraordinary to see the artifacts and maps that Lewis and Clark brought back and to think that he stood there with them and discussed these things. Yeah, it was quite a moving experience. And also, I've read a book by Isaac Asimov about the chronological aspects of scientific discovery and how everything's incremental, and what they brought back allowed other people to go out and see. I think it's quite important that we educate the youth to understand how they have to build on the past to see the future.
Simon? Hello, Simon. Did you hear that? We've lost Simon somehow. I haven't been to Monticello, but certainly Thomas Jefferson was a huge figure in all of this, and we'll talk more with Simon about Lewis and Clark's expedition, which comprises a big part of this book. The book is comprised in different elements. He treks all kinds of territory from Pittsburgh to Portland, Rochester to San Francisco, and Wood is the part of the book that when America's story was dominated by Wood, and that would have been certainly Thomas Jefferson's time. Interesting, brilliant man. And so we were beginning our conversation by talking with Simon about that. Just a reminder to you that Simon is going to be in Milwaukee this coming Friday evening. He'll be at Boswell Books, and as you can imagine, he'll be a great person to listen to on Friday night of this week at 7 o'clock as he talks about his book and his journey. And so that's that story. And let's you probably didn't hear that phone call, but Joe was talking about having been to Monticello. And I want to spend just a little bit more time on Lewis and Clark before we go to, please, Dwight Eisenhower, because I love the Dwight Eisenhower story about the Transcontinental Railroad, too. You know, when you think about it, and you must have really felt this when you walked on part of their and camped on part of their journey. What an extraordinary thing it was for these two people and what they encountered and how difficult and how dangerous it was to see what was beyond. It's really quite a story, isn't it?
It's an incredible story. And why not wanting to promote someone else's book? I mean, the definitive books on Lewis and Clark, like Stephen Ambrose, is just Undaunted Courage, I think. Mm-hmm. And that's what it was. It was Undaunted Courage. These were an amazing collection of men who, and I do, actually using the word men, I think I ought to say something here, because Sacagawea, mm-hmm. who they met up in the, what are now the Dakotas, is really the only woman in the entire story. And I know that inevitably some people are going to give me a bit of stick by saying, well, you know, is it really the men and only the men who united the States? Well, I'm afraid it is. The story of the physical uniting of the states, which is what this book is all about, really just involves men. And they were all men on this expedition until they met Sacagawea, and she accompanied them to the West Coast. But you're absolutely right, and that the point you're making is that it's such a heroic achievement, and they had all sorts of difficulties, weather, terrain. After all, no one had mapped any of this. They didn't know really where they were going. But then they saw this mountain, Mount St. Helens, and they realized that this was a mountain which had already been discovered from the other side, that people had come from the Pacific Ocean up the river and had seen Mount St. Helens, and they realized, therefore, that they were near the ocean and that they were near the end of at least part one of their journey. I traveled most of their journey. They began it in St. Charles, Missouri, just north of St. Louis, and headed off, 580 days or something, to get to what is now Astoria in Oregon. And then instead of being picked up by a ship and going back down across the Isthmus of Panama, they actually elected to walk all the way back as well, which makes it even more
goodness, heroic. Yes, so it does.
They were a remarkable group of people.
Yeah, they were. Thank you, Joe, so much for your call. Eugene in Viola is next. Hi, Eugene.
Good afternoon, Kathleen. I almost said good morning.
I know.
Yeah. Your guest mentioned rural electrification. Well, when I was very small, we moved into an old farmhouse about 9 miles out of Sauk City that had a 32-volt light plant. Now, where they got the number 32 volts, I don't know. But those 32-volt light plants were direct current. And they built those 32-volt light plants. Most of them, I think, were built by Delco. And they even had special light bulbs for them, and they were direct current. And you started your motor on gasoline, and then you switched it over to kerosene. And they were, the houses were wired what you call knob and tube or knob and whistle, pretty much. And the house I've got here in Viola still got the original wiring. It was a push button switches.
Oh.
And I get along with it just fine. But you can't set anything else on fire, start any fires, because your wires are all separated on those. But they were still using those 32-volt light plants until the late 1940s and early 1950s in the rural parts of South Dakota.
That's quite incredible. I mean, as you well know, when Edison first generated electricity for public consumption, that was DC, direct current, 100 volts, I think, in Pearl Street in Manhattan. And then you had this war of the currents between Westinghouse, who favored alternating current, and Edison, who said that alternating current was very dangerous and that DC was much, much better. And they did all these bizarre things, as you probably know, like Edison arranged for the electrocution of a circus elephant to show that AC was very dangerous. But in the end, people realized that this was nonsense and that AC, despite your experience with 32 volts DC, is actually a far more efficient way of transmitting electricity than Edison's, unless you want to electrocute an elephant, of course. But the stories of actually connecting the farms, I think, are so romantic that the farmers, excuse me for a sec, farmers paid $5 to join a co-op. And if they did, then the wire would come towards their house, and eventually engineers would come along and hook up the circuitry, and then there'd be that wonderful moment, usually at about 6 o'clock in the evening, when they were told that the lights would come on. And there's this lovely story of an elderly farmer standing on his dining room table, pulling the little cable next to the chain, next to the light bulb, and it comes on, and he's thrilled. And he shouts to his son in the next room, "Come here and hold this chain, and I'll go and switch the light on in the bedroom." And his son said, "Dad, you don't actually have to hold the chain. It'll stay on now. We've got electricity."
Oh, remarkable.
A different world.
Yes, it is. Thank you so much, Eugene, for your call. Lines are open if you'd like to speak with Simon. Our number is 800-486-8655. And let's look westward again, young man, and talk about Dwight Eisenhower for a moment. I never knew this story. Dark evening, Gettysburg, summer 1919, hot, scorching afternoon. And the young Colonel Eisenhower is looking west and says, "In 3,200 miles, I should reach the shores of the Pacific Ocean." He may have said that. And I never knew about this story that he did this. And boy, he had a hard time getting there. The roads were awful.
The genesis of this was that at the end of the First World War, the War College in Washington had the idea that perhaps the Japanese, who were getting rather restless, might attempt an invasion of America. How quickly, the general said, could American troops be sped across the country by such roads or railways as existed from the bases in the east of the United States? So they didn't know. They didn't really know what the condition of the roads were. They knew the railways simply didn't have the capacity to carry all the men and the vehicles that were necessary, but the roads might. So they established a convoy 3 miles long, outside the White House, on the south lawn of the White House. There's still a granite obelisk marking it to this day. And in August 1919, they set off westwards to reach California as quickly as they could, because the theory was that there was an invading army landing on the beaches at that moment. And the young man that came along as an observer was the young lieutenant, I must learn not to say lieutenant, now I'm an American, Lieutenant Eisenhower. And he acted as an observer and kept a diary of what happened. And it was, in many ways, a complete shambles. It took 58 days for them to cross the country at an average speed of nearly 6 miles an hour.
Oh, my goodness.
It was bridges broke, roads just disappeared, tanks were stuck in the sands, all sorts of vehicles crashed, a few men were badly injured. It was a disaster. And the realization was, and I followed in the footsteps by getting a copy of Eisenhower's diary and camping all the way across America, though I went slightly faster. The realization was that Americans' roads were simply not good enough. And Eisenhower vowed to himself that he ever got into a position of authority, he had no idea at all that one day he'd be president. If he ever got into a position of authority, he would see to it that America had a first-class road system, which is why to this day, the interstate highway system, the biggest construction project in the history of the world, is now called the Eisenhower Interstate Highway System. It's sort of conventionally believed that he actually had his aha moment in Europe after World War II when he saw the German autobahns, but in fact it goes much, much further back than that to 1919.
Where did you find that picture of Eisenhower? I think he's just west of Omaha, where things became really problematic and all these cars are kind of falling off this dirt road. It's an amazing picture.
Exasperated soldier with his arms on his waist thinking, what on earth is going on wrong now?
Right.
We did a lot of research for the pictures. And indeed, there is the Lincoln Highway Association, which looks after people that are curious to cross the country on U.S. 30, which is not an interstate route. It's U.S. 30, which goes effectively from Gettysburg to San Francisco, ends in Lincoln Park in San Francisco.
Oh.
That effectively is the journey that they took. And it's an extraordinary thing. I mean, I would commend any of your listeners that want to take a transcontinental trip and have time on their hands, although not 58 days these days, to go on the Lincoln Highway and experience some of what Eisenhower and that convoy experienced nearly 100 years ago.
Oh, sounds good to me. Simon Winchester is our guest, and Simon's latest book is The Men Who United the States, America's Explorers, Inventors, Eccentrics, and Mavericks, and the Creation of Our One Nation, Indivisible. He's going to be in Milwaukee this Friday night at Boswell Books, and what a talk that will be, huh? I'm Kathleen Dunn here in Milwaukee with John Munson, and this is Wisconsin Public Radio's Fall Membership Drive. Our goal is to keep bringing you discussions with people like Simon Winchester, and we do this. We do it day after day after day. Our goal is to receive 25 calls, and your support will make that happen. You provide the single largest piece of funding here at WPR. Please give now. Any amount makes a difference. WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Well, Kathleen, as you said, we need another 19 now, 19 pledges before 3 o'clock this afternoon. You can help pay for the programs you count on all year long. And thanks so much if you've already given. And if you haven't, well, no time like the present. WPR.org. 888-202-2552.
And we have 19 pledges to go in about 21 minutes. You fund the programs you rely on when you give now. WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
It's a couple of great hours of radio from 1 to 3 o'clock, Monday through Thursday. Books, history, sports, politics, social issues, education. We're here for you with important topics and, well, fun topics, too.
Yes, we appreciate you so much, and we appreciate our sustainers as well, members who give WPR such reliable monthly support. If you're already a sustainer, thank you. Make today the day that you increase your support by $5 a month, and really whatever amount you choose. Do that at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Well, giving to WPR is easy. Just takes a couple of minutes of your time and a gift of any amount. How about $10 a month? That sounds like a nice number. And then that donation will come back to you every day in the form of great programs. Make your contribution at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And as we said, Kathleen, we need 19 more pledges this hour to stay on track for our overall campaign goal. These hour-by-hour donation goals are always important. You could be the next person to make a pledge of support to Wisconsin Public Radio at 888-202-2552 or WPR.org.
Your call is important to us, so please leave a message after the beep.
You've got something dynamite. I mean, I just want to give the biggest, most sincere thanks to the people that had this as their brainchild and that worked to see it to its fruition. You know, it's one of the tools of democracy that we have. We don't have town hall meetings anymore, but we do have an electronic town hall meeting on the Ideas Network.
Go to WPR.org or 888-202-2552 to make your pledge of support during this fall membership drive. I'm Kathleen Dunn. John Munson is here in our studios, and we're asking for your support of WPR. Thank you in advance for your gift. $10, $15 a month or whatever amount is right for you. WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
You might appreciate WPR for the good it does for the whole community. For you, WPR is personally important, but you might also feel it's important that everyone in this state has access to high-quality information and entertainment.
So become a member with a contribution of $5 a month, and you're not only doing something good for yourself, you're doing something good for the whole community. Give at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Now, we heard from a listener who said he wasn't sleeping well at night out of guilt for listening to WPR but not donating. Don't let this happen to you. Don't lose sleep. Just make a donation right now.
It's quick. It's easy. And maybe you'll sleep better tonight.
Well, we'll sleep better if we know you've made a contribution.
Right,
how about that as an incentive? We need 19 more pledges in the next 20 minutes or so. You fund the programs you rely on when you give now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
You can get the new WPR travel mug when you give $15 a month or more. It's made by Clean Canteen, and it's available at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And we really appreciate our sustainers, members who give WPR such reliable monthly support. Now, if you're already a sustainer, thank you. Make today the day you increase your support of WPR by $5 a month or whatever amount you choose. You can do that at WPR.org or by calling 888-202-2552.
And thank you so much for your support of WPR. Thank you, John Munson. Simon Winchester is our guest this hour. His latest book, he's written so many of them. He's an acclaimed author of the New York Times bestsellers, The Professor and the Madman, Atlantic, The Man Who Loved China, A Crack in the Edge of the World. The latest book is The Men Who United the States, America's Explorers, Inventors, and Mavericks, and the Creation of One Nation Indivisible. And he's with us this hour. He's going to be in Milwaukee this coming Friday at Boswell Books at 7 o'clock. If you want to hear a terrific talk, you can hear that on Friday. And we're welcoming phone calls for him as well. Chad in Green Bay is our next caller. Hi, Chad.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call. I'm super excited to talk to you. My question is, I was watching, I don't know if I can mention a TV show by name that I was watching about 3 weeks ago on Comedy Central.
That's fine. Go right ahead.
It was called Drunk History, and it's really a hilarious show, whereas they depicted various people throughout history and tell a little story while getting the person who tells the story, who is a historian, a little drunk. Well, this story was on, and thank you, Simon, for talking about Lewis and Clark. I'm going to go back to that for a moment. They had the story about Lewis and Clark that when they got there, they were like, oh, all right, cool, you know, we reached the coast, and then they went back. My question is, what was the specifics on them talking to the president about them getting paid and not getting paid? I was curious about that, and I'm ashamed that I don't know my history about that.
I as far as I know, I thought they did get paid and reasonably well, although, as you probably know, Lewis later, I think it was Lewis, committed suicide.
Mm-hmm.
So he was a very unhappy individual after the expedition. But I got the impression maybe not all of the members of the expedition, there were 32, one of them died shortly after they set off from St. Charles, but the rest of them survived, and there may have been a squabble about whether they all got paid, but I believe the leaders got paid, but maybe you know otherwise.
Just that because of the suicide, that might have been a factor of him doing that, because they didn't get paid. Maybe they didn't get paid as much. But
I think there was more trouble about Meriwether Lewis than simply getting paid or not. He was a rather depressive personality, I think, and he had all sorts of other personal difficulties rather than not getting paid by the White House. So I think that wasn't a factor. But as I say, there may well have been a shortage of money that didn't allow all of the soldiers on the what was called the Corps of Discovery to be paid, but I'm not entirely sure.
Thanks very much for the call. We should talk about, it is the men, as you have said, and you call it the men because they were men, but the importance of Sacagawea to their journey.
Yes, I mean, all sorts of reasons. I mean, one of them is that her simple presence with her baby, because she was married to a French trapper, and they had a baby who the expedition called Pomp. The fact that she was with the men instantly rendered them less threatening to any Native Americans who they met en route. I mean, the whole question of the relationship between the Lewis and Clark expedition and the Native Americans they met along the way is a very, very interesting one, because they didn't always, we're talking about Lewis and Clark here, behave as well as they might, and indeed were pretty offhand and curt and somewhat unpleasant and arrogant to some of the Sioux between, as they traveled between what is now the Dakotas and Montana. And one can say that this kind of behavior sowed the seeds for the poor relations between white and Native American people in the years that followed. And I became, I must say, fascinated by that particular aspect of the story. But Sacagawea's presence was useful for all sorts of reasons. The men liked her. They liked having a baby to participate in looking after. Her presence seemed to render the expedition much less threatening than if it was simply a gathering of 32 American soldiers, which it would have been otherwise. And she also knew the local languages, or some of them, and she was able, therefore, to act as an interpreter. And as she got further and further west to where she had come from, because it is said that she had been kidnapped by one Indian group from the people in Idaho, where she had grown up, once she got back towards what is now Idaho, she spotted landmarks and was able to help as a guide. So when they got over the Continental Divide to see the rivers that led down to the Snake and the Columbia and the Pacific Ocean, she played a very big part in that. So she was enormously important.
Mm-hmm. And finally, we're in a pledge drive, and I appreciate your being through our many pledges. We'll look forward to seeing you in Milwaukee on Friday. You write quite poetically throughout the whole book, but this must be quite striking to you and must have been and made the ceremony when you became an American citizen rather emotional, that there is something. You talk about America's uniquely stable union, the factors that have ensured that a Chinese migrant in rain-swept Seattle can find himself locked in some mystical concord with a Sephardic Jewish woman in Manhattan, or a Cherokee student in Minnesota, or a Latina stallholder in a market in Albuquerque. How peculiarly American and really beautiful that is, that's what America is. It's just amazing, isn't it? It is some kind of mystical concord.
To me, it is amazing. I mean, when I went for my ceremony, which was held on the after deck of the USS Constitution, an old sailing ship in Boston Harbor, and with me were people from Somalia, from Gabon, from Pakistan, and suddenly we're all the same, and we can all have an American passport. And can all be, I mean, I tell you, I almost lost it when about 2 weeks later, using my brand new American passport, I returned to New York from somewhere overseas. I think I'd been in France or in England. And the immigration officer took my passport, looked at me and simply said, welcome home.
Oh,
and that was an amazing moment for me. And I'm sure the Somali and the Gabonese and the Pakistani felt exactly the same way. It's magical.
I'm sure. Well, thank you ever so much for being with us. You'll be in Milwaukee later this week. And what an extraordinary body of work you've given everybody. You've had quite a life, haven't you?
Well, it's not quite over yet, I hope. But no, I'm longing to come. I stayed at a terribly nice hotel last time. I was in Milwaukee. And the one thing I want to do, but I think I never have time, is to go and see how Harley Davidsons are made. But that'll have to wait for another occasion.
Oh, they'll be happy to host you, I'm sure. Thank you, Simon. Winchester. And we'll give you the name of the book and more details about his Milwaukee appearance here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And Simon will be in Milwaukee at Boswell Books in Milwaukee, wonderful bookstore, independent bookstore on Downer Avenue, 7 o'clock on Friday night. It should be just a wonderful, wonderful talk, considering what he did to put this lovely book together and what his life has been as well. This is the Wisconsin Public Radio Fall Membership Drive. I'm Kathleen Dunn with John Munson here in Milwaukee at WPR. Listener contributions really are the largest source of our funding. Your gift keeps the programs you value, including this one, on the air. Please make your contribution now, WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Give at WPR.org or 888-202-2552 and help pay for the programs you depend on. Well, we're looking for 13 pledges in the next few minutes before the top of the hour. You can be the next one at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
Giving is as easy as we can possibly make it. We need your name, contact information, the amount of your pledge, and how you would like to pay. It's just pretty easy.
Well, save time and money and use a credit card if you can. Or better yet, start automatic, sustaining donations directly from your bank account. You choose how to give, then do it. Make sure you do it at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And remember that Dar from Green Bay says Kathleen Dunn is my goddess.
No, I'm uncomfortable with
that. Well, I'll tell you what, though. Kathleen has lots of fans on Wisconsin Public Radio, and a lot of people listen to this program every day and count on Kathleen to have exciting guests and interesting guests about fascinating topics like the program we heard today, All Things Political every Monday. I know that's appointment listening for a lot of people. And that's what you get here with the Kathleen Dunn program on Wisconsin Public Radio. You don't get a show like this anywhere else.
That's true.
And the reason this show is possible is one pledge at a time, pledge by pledge, only on listener-supported Wisconsin Public Radio. So show your support for Kathleen's program and the rest of the great programming on this network. Go to WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Hello, everybody. It's Garrison Keillor here. Hoping you'll think about becoming a sustaining member of your public radio station. Sustaining members, in case you don't know about this, people who've made the choice to support public radio with ongoing monthly payments, which help save a lot of money every year in paper and stamps and staff time. So when you join or renew today, become a sustaining member. Here's someone with all the details.
And you can easily become a sustaining member, WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Your employer also might match your donation. You could double the value of your gift to WPR.
And if you don't know whether your employer will match your gift, well, pledge now and then go see somebody in your human resources department the next time you get a chance. Either way, please pledge your support to this program right now and to WPR at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
John, we have 13 pledges to go, and we have a few minutes to get there. It's possible. Be part of making it happen. Give now. WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
And be sure to ask for that new WPR travel mug with your pledge of $15 a month or more. It's handy and a nice reminder of how much you enjoy WPR. It's made by Clean Canteen. Get your new travel mug at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And Garrison was talking about becoming a sustainer. You can become one right now. All you have to do is set up ongoing monthly donations from your bank account or your credit card at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Join Janice from Pewaukee, who says, I love Kathleen Dunn. She has a way of making an interview with any guest uber interesting, regardless of the topic. Uber.
Uber,
we got that word in there.
Well, we tell them to so many fascinating people. This Simon Winchester, it's amazing what this guy has done with his life all over the world and this incredible journey. And now he's an American and he traveled all over the country in a tent and with those WPA maps. It's just fascinating, the people we meet
and
every day.
It's perfectly fine with me if he continues to say lieutenant.
You heard him say that. All right. John Munson, thanks ever so much. Always a great pleasure. Tell people again how they pledge.
WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
All right. And tomorrow, please join us. First hour, E.J. Dionne will be with us. We'll talk about the Tea Party. In the second hour, Robert Dalek, who's considered the preeminent Kennedy historian in the country. So thanks.